Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us here at the Mercatus Center. Before I introduce our speaker to you today, I'd like to address some of the sheets you have in front of you. First of all is the yellow sheet. That is a survey. We ask that you please fill out the survey and offer your thoughts and comments on it and hand it to one of my colleagues as you leave so that we can use what you comment about and try to make these courses better so we continually improve what we bring to you here. Also in front of you is a flyer for one of our courses next week. On Tuesday, May 20th, we have Dr. Julia Lane from the University of Chicago's National Opinion Research Center, and she will be looking at economic turbulence and the effects it has on the American economy. And also on this upcoming Thursday, a week from today, we have Lessons Learned in Disaster Relief, and this will be looking at some of our in-house work in Katrina and New Orleans and looking and seeing how that has worked out and what we have learned from that disaster and what we can then use for future disasters as well. So we invite you to attend both of those as well. Our speaker today is Dr. Jonathan Gifford. He has taught at Carnegie Mellon and MIT previously, and he currently teaches at George Mason University, where he's also the Director of Transportation Policy, Operations, and Logistics, the master's program. He's a specialist in highway and urban transportation policy and advanced technology in transportation systems. He had his undergraduate degree from Carnegie Mellon and his PhD from University of California at Berkeley. He's also trained as a civil engineer and has worked in the U.S. Office of Management and Budget, the CBO, and the Office of Technology Assessment. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Gifford.
Okay, is that microphone working? I'm delighted to be here, and I appreciate Mercatus giving me the opportunity to be here. My voice is, I'm fighting a cold a little bit, so I have a line of liquids here to sort of get me through the presentation, delighted to have you here. I should just say one correction. I was on sabbatical at MIT. I didn't actually teach, although it was the first time I'd been in an engineering school since graduate school, and I forgot. We don't have a machine shop in the School of Public Policy, but it was nice to be back in a place with real hard engineering. I want to talk today about the highway infrastructure, and I have to figure out how to use this thing here. So let's see if that wakes up. There we go. It wouldn't let me go backwards. So first, just a couple of, I was told, you know, many of you are not that, may not be obsessed with transportation policy the way that I am. So just a couple facts and figures about transportation in the US and where highways fit into that. And then focus some remarks on where we are today, sort of a showdown on highway finance that's looming, you know, just around the corner, within 6 months of today, the fiscal year 2009 will begin, and we don't really have funding to fund the highway program first time in 50-plus years that's been the case. So we're at a fairly critical juncture. I thought of calling it a meltdown, but it's really a bit more staged than that. I mean, everybody knew this was coming, and it's happening right on schedule, but timed to coincide with a presidential election, so it should be an interesting 6 months in the area of highway finance. We could talk a bit about how we got here. We could talk a month about how we got here, or a year, or you could spend a whole career looking at how we got here and where we ought to be going, but we'll talk a little bit about that. And then finally, some options going forward that may be available to us. I'm happy to take questions or comments. There's a couple experts here in the room, so if I say something grotesquely wrong, you can gently tell me that I've made a misstatement. I'd be happy to be corrected. And any of you who have questions as we go forward, feel free to interrupt if we begin to run out of time and I'm in danger of not getting to my last PowerPoint slide, which is always a crisis for a speaker, then I'll fast forward us a bit as we go ahead. So Transportation 101. Just looking at the overall U.S. passenger transportation system, this is not the latest data, but it's something I could pull together quickly. 25% increase over the 12-year period ending, or a 10-year period ending in 2004. Here are some numbers for 92 and 2004. 4.1 trillion passenger miles. A passenger mile is a passenger traveling a mile. So if you drive 10 miles to work, that's 10 passenger miles. If you ride a bus 10 miles to work, that's 10 passenger miles. Increased to about 5.5 or 5.4 trillion in the 12 years between 92 and 2004. So we've seen a big step up in travel. Highways have lost a small amount of market share, 90% in 92, 89% in 2004. Air travel from increased slightly from 9% to 10%. Transit and rail, 1%. And you may, if you've been reading the Post lately, have seen some remarks about the explosion in transit ridership that's occurred with our recent gas prices. That's probably true. but you have to remember that transit focuses primarily on the commute trip, which is a fairly small part of the overall travel utilization. But certainly it's the case with $4 gasoline that many people are stepping back and taking another look at public transit options and leaving their car at the park and ride or at home. So the expenditure, looking at the expenditure issue, I don't know what I did there, but $183 billion in 2001. Again, that's a little bit dated data, but it gives you an order of magnitude estimate. An increase of 29% over 10 years. Biggest increases in air transportation and water. And 30% increase in highway, a decline in rail investment, 27%. 60% highway, 20% transit. 14% air, that's how the spending breaks out. And the composition by level of government is 70% state and local, 30% federal. So the federal funding's critical. It's a third of the funding, but it's not, it's not by any means the major piece of the pie. The state and local piece is an absolutely essential piece. Looking at public revenue, we were just looking at spending. Now let's look at the revenue side. $125 billion in 2001, slight decline over the 10-year period adjusted for inflation. The composition of that revenue just about matches the expenditure, 66% state and local, 34% federal. And coverage, that is how much of the income is, or the expenditure is covered by income, 68% overall. So about 30% is paid for out of general funds. From the government, 68% from user fees. So if you look around the government, to say a large program area is paying 70% of its costs in user fees, that's not bad, actually. Federal coverage is a little bit higher at 76%, state and local at about 65%. The looking at some investment expenditures, $750 billion expended over the period, 12 years, 93 to 05. The public tax back is the vast majority of that. I mean, that's where most of the money comes from, 94%, mostly in the terms of municipal bonds or traditional funding, or the lion's share of it, public grant funding. So that's coming out of your gas tax, that 18 cent per gallon federal gas tax we've been hearing about a little in the news. In the last couple weeks, and state gas taxes, which vary state by state. Private contributions, significant, $50 billion in that period, or about 6+%. Concession financing through 05 was about $3 billion. That means signing a long-term concession agreement, like Chicago recently signed a 100-year agreement with Macquarie Bank in Australia to operate the Chicago Skyway. 100 years ago, 1908, it was fairly long, lots of changes in that 100 years. So the idea of signing a 100-year concession agreement gives pause to some people, that's for sure. User-backed grants are the more common form of private sector funding. That's bond issues or toll road financing, as you see with Pennsylvania Turnpike or New Jersey Turnpike, the Triborough Bridge Authority, or MTA Tunnels and Bridges, as it's now called, a major source of funding. And since these numbers were compiled, we've had a huge deal in Indiana. Governor Mitch Daniels took some heat for this, but signed a 75-year concession agreement for the Indiana Toll Road, basically turned over again to a consortium that included Macquarie to run the Indiana Toll Road for 75 years, collect the tolls, set the tolls, and raise the funds to do that. So we'll talk a little bit more about the private sector financing towards the end of the presentation. Highway Trust Fund, most of you probably heard the word, just to explain what it is, established in 1956. It's a dedicated fund for highways and transit. The revenue comes from motor fuel taxes and tire taxes. The expenditures split 80-20 highways and transit. So that's the major source of federal funding for highway finance. And as I mentioned a little bit earlier, that is going to be running out of money in the fiscal year beginning October 1. Let's see if I, there we are. So moving right along, looking at this issue of a showdown, the safety lieu, and I was trying to remember if I remembered every letter, Safe, Accountable, Flexible, Equitable, Transportation Efficiency Act, Legacy for Users. So that was the 2004 act that authorized funding for the trust fund through 2009, you know, the next fiscal year. And it was a compromise. The House Transportation Infrastructure Committee had a very aggressive position. Chairman Young wanted a $375 billion bill. The White House was extremely stalwart about saying they wanted a $256 billion bill. Safety Lou came in at 286. I think I have that number right. Am I approximately right at any rate? And it's on schedule, as I mentioned, to exhaust the trust fund next year. So we've known this was coming. You know, part of the politics behind that is, are we going to have a revenue increase? Are we going to have a tax increase for gas taxes at the federal level? And you know, tax increases are never popular and extremely political. And so there's just been a real showdown about whether we're going to have a revenue increase at the federal level or not. So it's going to be exhausted. Estimates that I had, and there's probably more recent estimates, $11 billion shortfall. The administration even proposed some rescissions last year that weren't taken up, as I understand it. And the Department of Transportation won't be able to commit to projects, state projects, for the 2009 construction season, so for the construction season that ends or that begins about a year from now. And as I mentioned, we have an election coming up in 2008. I should say, you know, to jump back to a sort of transportation 101, the federal government owns virtually no highways. They own a few parkways in national parks. They own some roadways in military bases. But the vast majority of highways in America are owned by state departments of transportation. So those highway trust fund dollars go to the states. The states use them then to contract for road expansions, road reconstruction, and so forth. So when you get to a situation where the government can't commit to the states that they'll be able to deliver on the authorized spending levels, it causes problems for the states. They have to cut back their construction programs, defer projects. It causes a fair amount of heartburn. And you know, puts a magnifying glass on this issue of what are we going to do about transportation funding going forward. These numbers are September 07, this Treasury estimate. So I'm sure our friends from CBO have more recent estimates, you know, that reflect the fact that we have $4 a gallon gasoline now, running from $30 billion. This is, I should have put a bigger letter here, this is 1998. This is 2017, so this is about where we are today. If you look, gas taxes are the main source. It's been slowing. That period from 98 to 06 going at about 3.7% per year. Going forward from 07 to 2016, growing at a much slower rate. So that is a concern, you know, long before our current gas price situation emerged. What are the causes of this? First of all, it's a per gallon tax. So the tax you pay is the same if gas is $4 a gallon or if it's $2 a gallon. You're still paying 18 cents a gallon. So it doesn't fluctuate. It's not a sales tax or an ad valorem tax. We also see some broader trends that are contributing to a slowdown in gas tax revenues, technological progress, hybrid vehicles, shift away from fossil fuels to ethanol, those sorts of things. And I'll talk at the end of the talk a little bit about hybrid vehicles and the potential that some people see in the hybrid domain. So, and people drive less, marginally anyway, when gas prices go up as they have in recent days. So there is a behavioral response to these prices. And I know when I filled my tank up at $85 the last time a couple weeks ago, that raises above my threshold for not an SUV even. It's just a four-door sedan. So a bit of a surprise. I want to say something about safety, because one of the important features of our interstate system is the fact that it has had a tremendous impact on safety. This starts in 1969 here. This is fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles. So that's a sort of rate that tells you how much, for a given amount of driving, how many accidents occur. On interstate highways, you can see that the number's gone down from about, I don't know how to get the laser, there it is, maybe, about 3 in 1969 when this chart begins, to something less than 1 in 2004. So it's cut, almost two-thirds of the fatality rate has been cut in that several decades. And on non-interstate highways, we've been making significant improvements there as well. Higher rates, those roadways don't have the safety features that interstate highways have, the high design speeds and so forth. But you can also see that in the last couple of decades, that has leveled out. So we said travel had increased 25% over the last decade. That means that we're seeing an increase in traffic fatalities, which is an alarming trend. The other thing I wanted to mention is U.S. logistics costs. What's happened to U.S. logistics costs? Now, total logistics costs is, you can see the labels here. It consists of inventory costs, transportation costs, and administration for moving freight around. And you can see that the administration cost is fairly small, just a couple of, it's a fairly thin bar there. Transportation costs are the significant piece, and inventory costs are a significant piece. And I think it's useful to spend a minute just saying, what do we mean, what is inventory cost? I mean, what do we mean by inventory cost? If you buy a $10,000 container full of dresses in China and ship it to America to be delivered to Nordstrom or Walmart, you've got $10,000 worth of inventory tied up for however many weeks it takes to go on the boat, land at Long Beach, get transported maybe by truck or rail across the country, delivered to Nordstrom or Walmart or wherever it's going. So that's a real cost. Say you're paying 5% interest on that, then if it's an eight-week trip, it adds significantly to the $10,000 you paid for that inventory. And if you can lessen that cost by moving it faster, then you can save inventory costs. So as our transportation system gets more efficient, transportation costs haven't changed that radically. But these inventory costs are where the big savings have come. The other part of inventory cost is obsolescence. When you order $10,000 worth of dresses and you put them in a container, as soon as that order is complete, the clock starts ticking. Fashions change, trends come along. The the dresses you thought you could get $15,000 or $20,000 for when you ordered them, might, because of a fashion change, be worth a lot less. So the faster you get the inventory to the point of sale, the less you have in the shrinkage, if you will, of technical or fashion obsolescence. So that's been a very positive trend. Starting here, this is gross domestic product, percent of gross domestic product. So that's this is our whole economy. Here we are paying, in 1980, 15% of our total economy devoted to moving stuff to point of sale. That's a huge number, and it's gone down to something on the order of 10% over that 20-year period. So that's a huge, that's a huge benefit to the economy, but, it's a little troubling to see it, going up here. And these numbers stop in 2005, before the recent spike in gas prices. So, what will happen when these numbers get put forward to 2008, those transportation costs will probably go up. So, our transportation system and our inventory management systems have been delivering big benefits and big gains in efficiency over the last 20 plus years. We're not sure whether we may have wrung all the productivity out of that that we're going to be able to wring. You know, sort of the Walmart model. We don't have warehouses. Our warehouses are on wheels. The stuff rolls, you know, to the Walmart through a distribution center, and it goes to point of purchase. You don't have to pay for warehouses. You don't have to pay to heat them, cool them, to unload trucks into them, to load trucks up out of them. But once we've done that, once we've deployed that innovation, what are we going to do next in order to try to bring some more efficiency out of the transportation system? So let me just pause there and see questions or comments so far, or corrections from our panel of experts here on the side. Yes. Okay. How did we get here? This is a picture. It's a later picture of the Gallatin Plan of 1808. So Congressman Blumenauer made a note on this earlier this year that we're having the bicentennial of our first national infrastructure plan. You can see this is the Cumberland Road going from here across the Appalachians and some canals. These railroads are, you know, drawn in by a later guy that wasn't in the Gallatin Plan, so pay no attention to those. But it sort of shows a picture of the original Gallatin proposals in roads, canals, and later the railroads that were added. So this was the first time we really had a comprehensive national plan. It was put together by, under President Jefferson, by Secretary of Treasury Gallatin, a really ambitious plan. Some people have called for us to have a new national plan, a third century plan for American infrastructure. What happened, it didn't last very long. The waterway system, the whole set of water resource systems, canals, waterways, ports, and harbors, went from a national system conceived by the Corps of Engineers, which was established late in the 18th century, and had very grand visions of a national system in the early 19th century. It very quickly moved to a system not terribly unlike what we have today. Every port and waterway project is sponsored by a member of Congress. And it's not a system that is drawn together by a national plan that was cooked up by a bunch of engineers who were saying, what's the most efficient way to do it? Now, former member of Congress Bud Schuster always liked to say, who do you think should make these decisions, angels in heaven? Of course, members of Congress have a right and a responsibility to decide how the public's taxpayer funds are distributed. And there's a big debate about whether technical experts or politicians or what combination of the two should determine these things. But that first grand national plan of the early 19th century didn't last very long. The Cumberland Road over the Appalachians to the Mississippi River was cut short and was never completed. So that was sort of one, you know, version 1.0, if you will. This is fast forward a century to the early 20th century, and we really did have a remarkable thing happen, which was we deployed a centrally planned, you might almost say un-American, national system of roads. I put the black shield down here in the corner. That's our US-1, which some of you are familiar with here in Maryland and Virginia, is part of that first generation road system that was conceived in the teens of the last century and then built out beginning in the 20s, starting through the Depression and into the end of the 30s. So this was a system designed primarily by engineers, not without political input, but primarily an engineered system. Constrained to consist of 7% of the roadways, the total roadway infrastructure. So the idea was the principal roadways connecting all of our economic points, ports, population centers, would all be served by this, by this system, and it wouldn't be determined by who was chairman of a particular committee or the head of a particular commission. It was supposed to be driven by technical criteria, and a very important part of that program was the value given to technical criteria in making these decisions. It's a much denser network in the Northeast, of course, than in the West and the South, because that's where the people and the economic activity were at that time in our history. So as I say, this was a first-generation road system that got built out in that period. This is the second-generation system, the interstate system that we finished, you know, a couple decades ago. This is a map from 1947 that sketched out the major roadways, a much sparser network, about 1% of our roadways that carries the bulk of the traffic to serve every state, but to try to focus on only those roads that are the most important. Design began in the late 30s. It was acted into law in 1944. The funding was an argument that took about 12 years to figure out, and finally in 56, that Highway Trust Fund I mentioned was put into place, and that has been what has served us in the ensuing half century. The interstate system, mentioned just some facts and figures, 45,000 miles, some design features, all four lanes, no at-grade intersections, no traffic signals, no driveways, no direct access to the highway except through a highway interchange, 1% of mileage. If you factor in the lanes, it's about 2.5% of lane mileage, carries 23% of the traffic on the system. So these are clearly the high, the high usage roads. Where are we today? The trust fund is heading to bankruptcy. Interstate is aging and needs to be rebuilt and reconstructed. We have huge regional shifts in our country, the South and the West, which weren't very populous at the time, have become very populous. I think most of the growth in the next 20 years, what's the Alan Pazarsky figure, will occur in three states, these three states. If you look at all the population growth in the country, it's going to be concentrated in these three states. And I think, in the industry, the inside, excuse me. The industry concern is that there's really no vision. The interstate system was decided upon in 56 and pretty much built for, was left alone. No earmarking, no special projects. It was left alone for decades. That doesn't happen very often in our system of government. It's a very unusual thing. It was driven by a vision of building out this interstate system, which had, generated a lot of consensus that it needed to be done. We have new issues, environment, greenhouse gases. Let me cough here. Concerns about air quality and regional equity. Those of you who've been around a little while will recognize the phrase donor, donee. Montana doesn't have enough people and gas tax revenue to pay for its system. Other states do in the densely populated Northeast. So for decades, they've been sending money to the donee states. They've been donating money to the donee states. Well, in the last 20 years, willingness to do that has really been breaking down. The elected officials from those donor states have said, why should my citizens be spending money to build roads in Montana? We need the money. We need the resources here at home. So it's a concern. Even in Northern Virginia, where George Mason is, there's this issue of regional equity comes back. Are we going to have a statewide tax to pay for the roads in Northern Virginia? It seems a bit fanciful for me to say you're going to tax Southwest Virginia in order to build roads in Fairfax County. People in Fairfax County are a little bit richer. But nonetheless, there's a debate about regional equity. So it's not just a national debate. It breaks down at the state level as well. Gas tax, this is only through 06, so the picture has gotten worse. The income line is the purple line here, going up rather nicely from 56 until 2006, so 50 years. The expenditure line, tracking it pretty well, but this is the line that is causing concern. That's the trust fund balance. We've gone from $30 billion in about 2000 to $10 billion in 2006, and it's headed towards zero come 2009. So this system that we've lived with very happily for 50 years is running into some trouble. So going forward, is it all a dark picture? I'll just talk about two issues. One that really focuses on fossil fuel dependence, greenhouse gas, and air quality issues. The other, private financing of highways. It's based only on one study, and it's a bit of a contrarian study. So I won't say that's a representative view of the industry, but I think it's still instructive to see how a big technological innovation can have a huge impact. Bernstein, Alliance Bernstein in New York, a firm, has their analysts who estimate that the hybrid could double fuel efficiency by 2030. So, and that's global vehicle fleet efficiency by 2030. So that's a pretty striking statement. The new car sales, 70% hybrid by 2030 by their estimate. Average fuel economy of 62 miles a gallon. Bringing the whole fleet, the new cars and the old cars, to 50 miles a gallon. Pretty remarkable prediction. Their argument is hybrid is a better technology. Any hybrid drivers here? Anybody drive a Prius or a? I've been rented one once or twice, and very nice cars. The Bernstein analysts say it's an inherently better technology in a lot of ways, from a maintenance standpoint, from a fuel efficiency standpoint, wear and tear, all those things. It has a big downside, which is there's about a $6,000 initial price difference. And if you're a regular user, their estimate, based on, we all remember 297 a gallon gas, right? And 12,250 miles a year, which is sort of an average household use, it'd be about 12 years. That'd be shorter now, but there's better things to do with your money if that's all you're concerned about, then put it into something that doesn't pay back for 12 years. You'll probably have a new car by then anyway. But they believe the market will be driven by heavy users, the New York City taxi drivers who drive, many tens of thousands of miles a year. And those folks will, through technological innovation, drive down that initial cost premium and allow a broader adoption of hybrid technology going forward. So it's pure economic forces there. If you reinforce that with tax, with tax preferences, which are certainly under consideration, it might go a little faster. This is their chart, and I think it's an interesting chart. Just reading down from the top, looking just at the gold bars are the International Energy Agency. The blue bars are Alliance Bernstein. So they pretty much agree that 2002, we had about 750 million cars in the world fleet, going up to something like 13 or 14, 1.3 or 1.4 billion by 2030. Average miles per vehicle not changing a lot from 7,500 or 8,000 up to something under 10,000 miles a year. Where they differ is in this fuel efficiency. And here you see no difference in 2002, no difference in their estimates to speak of in 2010, but by 2030 their estimate is that the fleet efficiency will double. And what I think is really remarkable about this analysis, and I certainly hope it's true, is that would reduce global fuel demand by 50%, from 32 million barrels a day to 16 million barrels a day. Now, I'm not a futurist, but I think, the idea that a hybrid technology breakthrough could have that powerful an effect on global fuel consumption or demand in 2030, I think, says there are some hope, there are some hopeful signs out there in what we can do with technology to try to deal with some of the things that concern us. This is just breaks down, the IEA is saying it's a 32% increase, Bernstein saying it's a 34% decrease. So a very big difference. So the other thing I wanted to talk about, and then I'll wrap up, is public-private partnerships. What do we mean by public-private partnership? It's really the bringing in private capital to finance the expansion of, or the repair of, or the improvement of highway infrastructure or transportation infrastructure more generally. There's a lot of interest in these long-term assets in pension funds, in university endowments. There's a lot of capital out there that's interested in finding very long-lived assets with very steady cash flows. And so that's the benefit from the investor side. They arranged, as I mentioned, the Chicago Skyway or the Indiana Toll Road long-term concessions, in that case 75 and 100 or 99 years. The expectation is, and I think it's probably true, that they'll get operational efficiencies, put in automatic toll collection technology, use the best available technology for road maintenance and system operations, intelligent transportation systems and things like that, and also increase the tolls or impose tolls in places where they haven't been imposed before. And so, you know, there's been a lot of alarm on the part of some members, you know, residents of Indiana, among others, about imposing tolls or raising tolls to such extreme levels. And I think the debate is still open about how much or how far this will bring things forward. 33 states have public-private partnerships in their road transportation or plans for them to implement projects. So that's a pretty big slice of our 50 states. Unfortunately, the data, and this is an area where we've been doing a little bit of work, the data on these is really terrible. It's very difficult to find any data. We've, and these numbers are approximate, but we've begun to pull together data, this for the period 85 to 07, looking at the total value of projects broken down by state. So you can see that Texas and Virginia are leading in this area. And we're, you know, beginning to see some sizable numbers. These are billions of dollars over here. So those are significant numbers. So I'd like to stop there. A few minutes before one. So throw the floor open to questions, and happy to have your questions or comments or corrections.
Thank you very much. If you all please join me in thanking. Thank you very much. And also, if you have the yellow sheets before you, if you'd be able to fill those out and hand them to my colleagues at the door as you head out, that'd be greatly appreciated. And if you have a question, please wait for the microphone so that we can make sure that everybody in the room can hear you. I'll let you call on whomever has a question.
Going once, going twice. I've blown them away. Anybody want to take the first question? Here's one here.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about prioritization of projects and, you know, if Congress should do this or should there be an outside body or what's the best way to put the most important projects first, you know, kind of that sort of thing.
So. Well, that's an excellent question, and I think it's a very tough question. You know, should angels in heaven be doing this over in the Federal Highway Administration or the State Department of Transportation, or should members of Congress and their staff be trying to prioritize projects? And I don't think, I don't think there's an easy answer to that. There is PPPs offer one test. That's a financial market test. And, you know, for projects that can, command private financing and survive a market test, I think the market is pretty good at sorting out how much money to put into those projects. But we have a lot of projects that don't meet that market test, not at 100% cost. And I think that's where, you know, there's obviously is a public role. One of the questions about PPPs that's asked is, you know, what is a national system? Is it just, you know, a collection of individual public-private partnerships? And if you're a Montana or an Idaho or a North Dakota, you just fall off the table. You don't get any money because you don't have any market worthy projects. And I don't think we have an easy answer to, you know, how to do that. I gave, you know, two examples, or three examples actually. You know, this Gallatin plan is number one, and then the primary highway system and the interstate highway system. Gallatin plan fell apart pretty quickly. The primary highway system did pretty well, got built out. The interstate highway system did pretty well until, you know, the early 90s. You know, President Reagan vetoed the 86 Act, I think, because it had two earmarks in it or something like that. I mean, that was then. This is now. And you know, that's a remarkable thing, you know, that Congress, which has a strong interest in these things and projects have a huge impact on their states and districts, you know, would step back and say, we drew a map in 1956, and we're going to build out that map. You know, that map had about 44,000 miles of highways on it, and the system we built was about 44,000 miles. There were a very few additions to that going up through the 1980s. So that's a really, I think it's a remarkable fact in you know, 20th century, for 20th century American government, that we would actually stick to that plan. And it's not all good. You know, there's no, I think it's still true, there's no road, there's no highway, truck, you know, high-capacity highway between Las Vegas and Phoenix. Well, those are, you know, two huge metropolitan areas that weren't anticipated back in 1956. And so, you know, saying, well, it's not on the 1956 map, and so we're not going to put it in, you know, that's not always a good idea. But how you also worry about, you know, the bridges to nowhere and the roads to nowhere that may provide a short-term economic stimulus for whoever's getting the project, but deliver very few transportation benefits and safety benefits and logistics cost benefits. And so, you know, there's a responsibility to try to weigh these things. I don't have an easy answer for that question, but I think it's one of the tough, you know, it's one of the tougher ones we confront. How much expertise versus how much political, because unfortunately, the technical experts can't answer all the questions. There are projects that you know, don't pass an efficiency test that still need to be there. You look at our system of government, our electoral college, you know, the big empty states and the very small states have a big voice in part of our Congress, and that's part of the condition of joining the Union and signing the Constitution. You know, that was the agreement, and that's all about regional equity. And so, so it's not, I don't think, adequate to just say, if it doesn't pass a market test, it ain't going to fly. So a very good question. I wish I had a better answer for you. Other questions?
Okay. Well, seeing no more questions, I hope all of you have an enjoyable Thursday afternoon. And please join us again next Tuesday for our course on economic turbulence. Thank you for joining us.
Great. Thank you very much.